Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, well, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Ah!
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity weight, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Bye. 619-768-2945. Before we get into that, let me lay a little groundwork here. Statistically, in the United States, there are 19,502 municipalities. 19,502 municipalities that are, and municipalities are basically communities that have incorporated themselves, their municipal corporations. Now, let me give a breakdown of that, because this sort of lays the ground towards household energy, the politics of household energy that we're going to discuss today, along with any other trending topics that you might want to talk about during this holiday season. Okay, out of that 19,504 municipalities here in the United States, only 10 cities have, matter of fact, let me bring up population of the United States. Okay. The United States has a population of 32,500,000 people. Okay. Now, so within that, over 300 million people, 329,500,000 people, give or take, depends on who's born, who's gone. 10 cities that have a population of a million people. Just 10. That's out of 19,502 municipalities. The municipalities or the cities that have a population of 500,000 to 999,000, there are 27 of those. The cities that have a population of 250,000 to 499,999, there are just 52 of those. The cities that have a population of 100,000 to 249,000, there are just 225 of those cities. The cities that have a population of 50,000 to 99,000 people, or 99,999 people, there are 466 of those cities in the United States. Now, all total, the cities that have anywhere from a minimum of 50,000 people to a million plus people, there's only that only covers 4% of the total population of the United States. That's it. There are 25,000 cities that have a population of 25,000 to 49,000 people. There's 741 cities in the United States that have that number. Cities that have a population of 10,000 to 24,999, there are 1,572 of those cities. So the cities that have a population of a minimum of 10,000 to 49,999, that's about 49% of the United States. And in my opinion, it's in those numbers that you're in the real United States in cities with that type of population. Now, the cities that have, or towns that have a population of 1,000 people or less, once again, the towns that have a population of 1,000 people or less make up 47% of the population of the United States. Almost half. Almost half. So when we come back, we're going to, I'm lining up something for you guys. We're going to get into the politics of household energy. The higher the population, the denser the population, the more political play there is. But what I'm saying, based on my boots-on-the-ground experience and history, that if you want to look into the future, look at the towns or villages that have a population of 1,000 people or less. You go to those towns today, you'll get a glimpse at what's coming tomorrow.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word, because as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo, because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change comes to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch got nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga kid. That nigga hurting himself.
You from Nuke State.
It's over. What I say is over. Everybody get the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck it.
Let's go across the street.
Now who got them rights?
I ain't caught it. I'll slap the fuck out of one of them.
that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns, because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations, like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield. See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, The Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavored Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-Civil Rights Movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them, which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place. There's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city.
Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe, but they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away. But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock. Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day. When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year, but Yupa wants more. Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-Yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of, it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiamen, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly lines. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investment. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only two daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work, and there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupa and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
然后工作上面我们是有一点的话就有关系嘛。
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yuba in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yupa management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Li is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Li's model, Yupa could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Li's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Li's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Li's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xingming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xingming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Li runs one of five independent restaurants at Yupa. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin. And Li needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop by for lunch. Lee expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, we still didn't have much food to eat.
Now food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasoning that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
Might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all. Now in his second year on the job, Ya Shin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job, address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
Leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 US dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai, many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenant's rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees and they come from all over China. Everyone has different tastes. I have to take care of everybody.
Yupa's restaurants are extremely competitive, and some have been known to skimp on meat portions to keep costs low.
This is
UPA has strict rules about when and where vendors can sell their food. Foo keeps them in line.
Now we are going to check on the other restaurants. We have designated areas for them. If they break the rules, I will kick them out.
These vendors aren't trespassing. They work for the factory's restaurants. But they are breaking the rules by selling food too close to rival restaurants. Everyone must have a permit. A veteran on these streets, Fu recognizes this woman. He busted her once before. Today, Fu lets everyone off with a warning. Next time, he may ban them from selling food at UPA.
I talk to them, but they will break the rules again, so I have to check on them every day.
China's web of cultures complicates Fu's job.
Everyone comes from different families and different provinces, so their customs of eating and living are totally different, so I have to adapt to them.
But one thing unites all of UPA's workers, the world's most popular sport. On the field, tension and stress vanish.
Because employees are undergoing a lot of pressure at work, we have to give them an outlet and let them exercise. But most important is the team building.
Don't care for soccer? UPA offers other ways for workers to get their exercise.
For entertainment, we have ball game competitions like basketball, table tennis, and other games. These sorts of competitions.
It's all part of Fu's mission at one of the world's biggest factories. A place with no boundaries between work and life. For Fu, it's a never-ending battle to keep the peace and to keep the company together.
It really is a miracle, a company this big, with all the employees together, holding hands, and moving forward. This is not easy.
And while there may be harmony inside UPA's walls, outside, competition is cutthroat. In a global market, innovation is key. UPA's employees must endure tough changes to survive. In the global marketplace, there's no room for second best. To survive, companies need a competitive edge. Like most China-based companies, UPA has relied on low labor costs, making products designed by others. But it wants to move up the production food chain. UPA's leaders want to design products of their own. They have little choice. To thrive and survive, UPA must develop a new generation of products. The factory's very existence depends on it. Thousands of jobs hang in the balance.
No work means not being able to live. This is a fundamental requirement. It's how humans survive. You have to earn money to make a living, and to earn money, you have to work.
Ji Rong Pan knows how high the stakes are. He is UPA's Vice President of Product Innovation.
I think innovation is the competitive edge of our company. Because our company is in the field of home appliances and the whole home appliance industry is a lifestyle industry.
Mr. Pan sent his staff overseas to study the lifestyle products of the future. They returned with a simple message. The future is green.
We studied the consumers of North America and Europe and their thoughts on this new energy of the future. So we know that their love of the earth is actually very strong.
Pan and his designers make a bold decision. The first appliance in UPA's new product line will be powered by the sun. It's a solar CD player.
We want to bring this clean solar energy concept into people's homes.
Going solar may sound easy, but solar panels are expensive, and they're meant to work outside, not in the dim corners of people's homes. A 3D image of Yupa's appliance of the future starts to emerge. Now the team must turn a digital design into reality.
This factory is a very important part of our development process. It helps turn a product concept into a finished prototype.
Using the design specs, a computerized milling machine cuts a foam cast. And the cast is converted into a hard plastic prototype. If things go according to plan, the model will be used to produce millions of identical copies.
It allows us to test the product to see if this fulfills our requirements while bringing value to the customers.
Now engineers perfect the solar power system. The system must collect and store solar energy. Every aspect of design must maximize energy efficiency.
We've spent a lot of time studying this. What kind of technology, what kind of material, what kind of parts can help us improve our energy efficiency?
Finally, Yupa's product of the future is revealed. The solar CD player is simple and elegant. The player will charge indoors when left near a window. And the system is uniquely versatile. It will work with any energy-efficient appliance Yupa designs. But one question remains. Will the world embrace Chinese solar products?
We want to bring what people originally thought of as an industrial thing and truly integrate it into their daily lives to enable consumers to truly experience solar energy. This is a very magical energy concept.
If these innovative products succeed, Yupa could achieve its dream, a dream it shares with China, to be the factory of the world.
I want consumers and everyone to have faith in our products and faith in the workers. I hope everyone can enjoy the products we produce. This will make us proud.
With Factory City in full swing and new products in the works, more and more goods will carry the Made in China label. But for China and Factory City, growth comes at a cost. Every day, the 17,000 people at Yupa endure the stress and uncertainty of a cutthroat world economy. To fight off fierce competitors and build a better life, these men and women work and live together as one at the factory of the world.
Organizations like the SBA making it easier for you to get into business. But 50 years ago, what do you think the odds would be that you could start your own small business and make it succeed?
The odds were against a black man succeeding in the business world, but John Johnson has never been one to look at the downside. He used $500, perseverance, faith, and family devotion to build an empire worth nearly $200 million. His name is now a legend in the world of publishing, fashion, beauty products, and broadcasting. John Johnson has a formula for taking what seems impossible and making it real. His story is an inspiration for people of all colors.
Well, I guess it just proves in a continuing way that there is opportunity there. That given the knowledge, the devotion, and the sacrifice, that success can come. So it ought to tell us that more young blacks ought to take a chance. I think really that in the past, when young blacks have gone to college, we have assumed that we did not get respect and prestige unless we went into the professions. I think now more and more that is changing. We're recognizing that money and success gives you prestige and recognition, even though it may come from selling hamburgers, it may come from selling barbecue, it may come from opening a grocery store or running a cleaning plant or any other thing. And I think as we move ahead and as those areas, the business area, gets more recognition and more credibility, then I think more young people will go into it. Unfortunately, in the white corporate world as we know it today, there is a ceiling on how far blacks can go. There are rare exceptions, but by and large, the vice presidency is as far as you can go. Now, there are some of us who are not just temperamentally suited to be only vice president. We want to be presidents. We want to run things. We want to be in charge. For those people, I say, you've got to go out and start your own. And so I believe for people who are satisfied to be a vice president, perhaps in the long run, for people who want to work for someone else and to live under the fear now of mergers and buyouts, all of which jeopardize their security, if they want to live that way, fine. But if they really want to have a degree of security, a degree of fulfillment, if they want to make a contribution to the race as a whole, then I think they need to go out and start their own.
If you had to do it all over again today, what type of business would you go into?
If I was starting over again today and if all the publications were in place that are in place today, I don't think I'd go into the publishing business. I think I'd be inclined to go into the service business, somewhere where you're rendering service. I might want to start my own chain of hamburger places. I still think it's very sad that we don't have barbecue franchises. I think we could develop cleaning establishment franchises. I think anything that would give service to the public would be a good thing to go into now. Because service is no longer important to people. You walk around and people are arrogant. They're insensitive. They don't want to serve. So I'd want to be in something where service would move me ahead.
What advice would you give a small business going after a larger client?
And I developed a simple philosophy. I said that I would call companies and they all wanted to refer me to the contributions department. And I say, no, I don't want a contribution. I want to give you something in return for your giving me something. I would always say that if the president of the smallest country in the world came to America, our president, as a matter of public policy and protocol, would see that president. And I said to the people, I am the president of a very small company, but I am the president. And I feel that as a matter of courtesy, your president ought to see me. Now, I have to say I was never turned down. I was put aside, I was delayed, but I was never turned down. And persistence went out. I think what you need more than anything else in going into business is persistence, a refusal to give up, a motivation to continue when everything looks like you ought to quit. And I think that's what entrepreneurs have to have.
How important is access to information to the small business person?
There's a great need for information. There are all kinds of people out there who are writing me letters and calling up with good ideas and wanting to know how to go into business. So I think if we had a national television show devoted to business development, it would be a great thing.
All right, today's podcast is titled The Politics of Household Energy, and we're going to get into the meat of it now. We go to trending topics at So Be That Too. Now, I read some statistics, and there was a lecture on Clubhouse. They only have it once a week, so I had to tune into that. That's why I played the other stuff. But anyway, so today, the politics of household energy. And the stats that I read at the beginning of the podcast today is, and I've given some of these numbers before, but they are more detailed now. And I've posted this on our Blog Talk program notes for today, so you can look at it on today's program notes for Blog Talk Radio. All right, politics of household energy. Now, first things first, according to the stats that I've looked up online, there are 19,502 municipalities in the United States of America. Now, municipalities are basically communities that have incorporated themselves in with a municipal corporation. All right. 19,502. There are more communities or towns than that, but that's how many that are listed that have incorporated themselves via municipal corporations. All right, I haven't found that. There's a lot of towns in the United States. It's probably double, triple, maybe quadruple of this figure here. Now, let me break that down, because this has everything to do with, well, not only a whole lot of things, social issues, household energy, and some other stuff. Anyway, so the number of cities in the United States that are municipalities that have a population, now, and by the way, the population of the United States is over 300 million people. Matter of fact, let me go, because I rounded that down. And I did give that, no, I don't want to go to Netflix yet. It's too early in the day for that. Population, okay, of the United States. You know what, let me go to population clock. They got 329 million, but I want to go, put clock in here. For the population clock, U.S. Census Bureau, and this is give us what we want in real time. Okay. The population of the United States in real time right now is 332,968,330. It's approaching one right now. So over 332 million people are in the United States. All right, let's go back to our stats. Living within the confines of these 332 million people are spread out among, well, as far as the municipalities, not the entire United States, but within the municipalities of the United States, 19,502. They're spread out among those and a little bit more, because we're not including the towns that are not on radar. All right. Now, out of that 332 million plus, which live in 19,502 municipalities, only 10 towns have a population of a million people or more. New York City, Chicago's number two, New York City's number one, and New York City is split up into five boroughs. More black people live in the Brooklyn borough than any other city in the United States, but that's another topic. You have Chicago number two and Los Angeles number three. The state of Texas has three cities that have a population of a million or more people. The Dallas area, Dallas, Texas, Houston, Texas, and San Antonio. I mean, a percentage of the total population of the United States just lives in those cities I just named. But there's only 10 of them out of the 19,000 plus in the United States. Then you have towns that have a population of 500,000 to 999,000 is 27 cities like that. Population towns, there are 52 cities that have a population of 250,000 to 499,999 people. There are 225 cities that have a population of 100,000 or more. There are 466 cities that have a population of 50,000 to 999 people. Now, from 50,000 people to New York's, which is the largest, which population of New York City. Population of New York City. Oh, come on now. NYC. New York City has a population of 8,419,000 people. Percentage of the total population of the entire United States in just one city. Okay. In any event, but let's look at the full landscape here. Now, from towns that have a population of 50,000 to a million, including New York City has over 8 million, that only makes up 4% of the total population of the United States. The vast majority, I mean, a lot of the population is in that 4%, but it only makes up 4%. Now, there's 741 cities that have a population of 25,000 people to 49,000 people. One of those places is Zanesville, Ohio. I've been there. You step, and I caught a Greyhound to get there because I had to attend an Earthship building class, house building, or Earthships are not houses, but they're homes. But I had to go into Zanesville. I got there by Greyhound. You step off the bus in Zanesville, you know that you're in the real United States of America. Washington, D.C., Chicago, New York, L.A., those places, they're in the United States, but they're not the real United States. Take a trip to a town that's got 25,000 people or less. You'll know what I'm talking about. All right, so there are 466 cities like that in the United States. Excuse me, 741 cities like that in the United States. Population, 25,000 to 49,000 people. All right. Now, there are towns that have a population of 10,000 people to 24,999. There are 1,572 cities like that in the United States. Now, the towns between 10,000 people and 49,999 people, that makes up 49% of the United States, all right? Kyle Rittenhouse lives in the real United States of America. Because you have a lot of people that live in the top 10 most populated cities in the United States that they don't understand the dynamics of what happened with the Rittenhouse case. Two different worlds. Two completely different worlds. The real United States, at least according to L.A., is in the 49%, a part of it is in that 49%. Population 10,000 people to 49,999 people. Now, almost at 50%, it's at 47%. 47% of the United States, and I'm going to tie this all into the politics of household energy. 49% of the United States, 47% of the United States, okay, lives in communities, towns, And we're talking about the ones that are municipally incorporated, that have a population of 1,000 people or less. That makes up 47% of the United States. Almost half. Now, before I get into the politics of energy, let's look at some of the social issues here. Most of the news stories that you hear in the so-called mainstream media and, you know, with the Black Lives Matter, the shooting of black men by white police, most of the crimes that you hear about that are read in the mainstream news are basically stuff that happens only with 4% of the total population of the United States. Kyle Rittenhouse's story would be part of the 49%, because where that happened, and 49% is nearly half, in Kenosha, I think Kenosha has a population of, I think 100,000. But that, you know what, but once again, that's all within that 4%. Kenosha, Wisconsin is within the 4%. And once again, the population for that is towns that have a population of 50,000 all the way up to 1 million people or more. That's just 4%. And for a lot of people, you're missing out on where the action is. Where the action is, and I'm telling you this just based on my life experiences, okay, is in the towns that have populations of 1,000 people or less, that's where the action is. Cable is normalized in households now, but cable first hit in towns that have a population of 1,000 people or less. A lot of the innovations that you'll see tomorrow are already in the towns, not only in the United States, but around the globe. They have a population of 1 million people or less. And a lot of it is due to the politics of whatever you want to call it. We're going to get into the politics of household energy in a moment, but because there were politics of cable. Washington, D.C., where I grew up at, was one of the last places in the United States to get cable. But local politics in D.C., I'm not talking about, you know, the Congress and the Senate and all that. Local politics in D.C., it's one of the reasons, I mean, man, D.C., I'm surprised that they got marijuana legal there that quick. But very political. To school, when I graduated from high school and went to Canyon, Texas, and matter of fact, let's look up the population. Let's look up what's happening in Canyon today. And I got to call some of my college buddies later today. And I'm tying this all into the politics of household energy. The population of Canyon, Texas today is 13,303 people. Canyon is what I would call the real United States of America. Okay. When I went to college, it was 1976. There was no such thing as cable television in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. That's Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C. proper, the Maryland suburbs, bringing on up the, what do you call it? What's that place called? Baltimore. No such thing as cable television. And I even in Philadelphia, I don't think. Because I went to school. After I've graduated undergraduate school, I went to Howard University for grad school for a year. And one of my classmates, and we're friends to this day, her dad got the cable franchise for the city of Philadelphia. So We're talking about a region from Philadelphia on down to North Virginia. I'm not going to go as far as Richmond, but probably down in Richmond, did not have cable television. I had not heard of the concept of cable television until I went to the panhandle of West Texas in 1976. It was normal there. It was normal. Ted Turner Superstation, all that, it was normal. I graduated in 1980. There was no such thing as cable television in D.C. They tried to get cable in, and it was some station called, I forgot what they call it, Super TV or something like that. But it didn't catch, and they went out of business. But that was after I graduated. That's 4 years later. And I was probably out about a couple of years after that. And D.C.'s not even at D.C.'s probably in the top 20 cities, 25 cities as far as population in the United States right now. I'm going to tie this all into the politics of energy. One of the reasons why, if you got anything that you want to scale up, start small. That's one of the things I learned over a series of years, some decades, is go to the Canyon Texases of the world. Get your business off the ground in those places and then scale up to the larger cities. Depends on what you want to do. But that's how it was done with cable and a whole lot of other industries and businesses and what have you. Okay? Even what I'm doing right now, I'm following that same model. I go micro. Now, let's see here. Okay, we're done. All right, New York City's got over 8 million people. All right, now, we're done with the world population. All right, let's go to Oklahoma. Now, once again, 47% of the population of the entire United States lives in communities that have a population of 1,000 people or less. Once again, if you want to see what's happening tomorrow, or what's going to happen tomorrow, look in towns that have a population of 1,000 people or less, not only in the United States, but around the globe. Now, let's go to Oklahoma. Where the action is, not only in Oklahoma, if you want to look into tomorrow, here are the kind of towns L.A. likes to hang out and visit. Adar, Oklahoma, population, 808 people. Ochilee, Oklahoma, 507 people. Aline, Oklahoma, 215 people. Now, several of you know that I have a vested interest in Taft, Oklahoma. And let me see, what's the population of Taft, Oklahoma? I know what it is, but I'm just reading it, you guys, but they have you on city data. Taft, Oklahoma, according to this, has a population of 246 people. What is legally allowed to include in the population of Taft, Oklahoma, they have a women's prison and a men's prison. They include the population of those two prisons into the people that live free there as well. All right. Now, in this list that I'm looking at on city data, there are other towns in Oklahoma that I have set foot in more than once that are not on this list. One town that I was trying to get to the last time I was in Oklahoma is Redbird, Oklahoma. It's a historic black township. Now, there's a red bird. Let me look it up. There's a red bird, hold it, on here, but it's not the red bird, Oklahoma, I'm talking about. Two other towns, matter of fact, I'm just put it out here because I've had the mayor on in this town before in Oklahoma. I'll just say it's the oldest city in Oklahoma, which is Tallahassee, Oklahoma. That's the oldest black township in the state of Oklahoma. It existed before the state of Oklahoma became a part of the United States. It's not listed on this. So there's a lot of communities around the United States, and they have a mayor and a city council. I sat down and had dinner with the mayor, her dad, and her son. And they gave me a tour around Tallahassee. But it's not lit. Now, you can find them in Wikipedia, but you on a lot of statistical data that comes from the census bureau, you won't find a lot of these towns listed. I like going to those towns because that's where there's a lot of opportunities, particularly for the little guy, to get in on. Tomorrow's billionaires, you're going to find them in these little towns. Or tomorrow's the innovations that are coming to your town tomorrow or next week or next month, they're in these little towns now. All right. Because the politics is just dramatically less. There is some politics, but it's easier for a little guy to go in there, and we're going overtime as we usually do, to get in these towns. I'm tying this all into the politics of household energy. All right. Now, there's another community, which is unincorporated, that's in Oklahoma that I've been through to a few times. Blackjack, Oklahoma. Blackjack, Oklahoma is a historic black community. I've looked on the internet, and I haven't found anything about Blackjack, Oklahoma yet. I found out about Blackjack, Oklahoma on the humble. I was at a city council member in Taft, Oklahoma, and you can drive 45 minutes away from Taft and go to Tulsa, Oklahoma. And between Tulsa, Oklahoma, and then the largest city in Oklahoma, which is Oklahoma City, between those cities, if you have ask the average black person on the street, have you heard of Taft, Oklahoma, or Blackjack, Oklahoma? And they're going to say no. Most people live in a very, very small world that's about 60 minutes large. That's about it. We're going over time, as I said, as usual. We're tying this all into the politics of household energy. The reason why I go to small towns like Oklahoma, the reason why I have a four-acre tract, which I'm sharing with other people now, and in northern Florida, 3 hours away. I'm in Florida right now myself, but the tract is 4 hours away. The reason why is because in the small cities, in the very small cities as citydata.com describes them, is because the little guy has less politics, dramatically less politics to deal with. Less rules and regulations than the larger cities. All right? It's almost like you're in a developing country. Because really one of the distinctions between a developing country or third world country, whatever you might call it, and a developed country, there's less rules and regulations. There's less government. In my opinion, more freedom. More freedom to do what you want to do. There's some rules, and there's some politics, but it's dramatically, like on a scale of 1 to 100, it's like 1. What has this got to do with the politics of energy? I'll pick a city that I know well to start off. Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C., there are three utility companies. Washington, D.C. proper. Pepco, they're the local monopoly for electricity. They have got every politician that's ever been in office in my lifetime so far, they got them all in their pocket, including the mayor and whoever will be the next mayor and the next mayor after that. Like I say, they have their little monopoly. No competition. They have a rate increase. It goes through. Natural gas. For people who cook food using natural gas and heat their homes using natural gas, it's Washington Gas. They're in a local monopoly for the town of Washington, D.C. Same thing as Pepco. They got a lockdown on every politician that's in office and who will be in office in the foreseeable future. And then the city itself of Washington, D.C. has the water company, municipal water. You don't pay the water bill in Washington, D.C., even if your million-dollar house has been, the mortgage has been paid off. You don't pay that water bill. They'll put it up for auction and sell the water bill in your house along with it. That does happen, people, more often than you think. All right. Now, so you do see solar in Washington, D.C. right now, but it's not even 1% of the population that has solar. One of the reasons why is because of the cost of it, and then two, it's become regulated in D.C. And in my opinion, over-regulated. But it's not in Pepco's best interest, because when Pepco or any energy monopoly, they'll say, well, you know, we're developing a solar field or farm or whatever, and they want to have, Pepco wants to be the one, Con Edison wants to be the one, PG&E, they want to own the solar panels and then sell you the energy. Or they want to own the solar panels and sell you the solar panels. They want to buy wholesale and then sell to you retail. That's what they want. Fuck that. But there's a choice here. Once again, in the United States, 47% of the population lives in towns and communities that have a population of 1,000 people or less. I frequent towns that have a population of less than 400 people. When I go somewhere and I'm at the airport, thus, so far, the mayor or blood relative of the mayor has picked me up at the airport every time I've gone. And in these places, there's a lot, some of these places, matter of fact, practically every place I go to, there's no code enforcement. The zoning's real light, and you can build and do what you want to do. And there's a lot of places like that all over the United States. Black folks, if you want to get away, you know what, stop all, the late Charles Charlie said this. He had a catchphrase, stop marching and start packing. Now, I'm not talking about going out of the United States. Pack your shit if you live in Chicago and go to some place like Hopkins Park, Illinois. Some place rural. You can stay in the same state. Someplace rural where there's less rules and regulations and you can legally operate. You can have your solar panels or whatever else. I'm going to play this one audio, then we're going to get more deeper into the politics of household energy, because that's really what it comes down to. I frequent towns and communities that have a population of less than 400 people because I don't have to deal with the politics, the big city bullshit politics. I don't have Pepco money. I don't have money. I don't have millions of dollars to go around the table to bankroll the election of any city council member in Washington, D.C., or the mayor, or the person that wants to run for mayor. I don't have it like that yet. So, top of that, in Washington, D.C., there's no place where you can buy even, a private citizen can even buy an acre of land. My pocketbook fits populations of 400 people or less. Places where I can call, matter of fact, Robin told me to call the mayor of some particular town in Texas. I called, and the mayor picked up the phone. We had a nice little 15, 20-minute conversation. I said, I got this 10 acres right by your town. She knew about it. Then she gave me a whole landscape, really on Texas, stuff I didn't know. But firsthand information from the mayor who picks up her own phone. That's not going to happen in Washington, D.C., not unless I come out and write some big-ass checks. That's all part of the politics of energy. What we're doing with our 4 acres in Hamilton County, like I said, phase one, is we're going to do a solar farm. I can do that legally in this part of Hamilton County. All I had to do was keep up my property taxes, which is under $150, actually $140 a year. And that's if I pay the property taxes late. Here are my rules. Pay the property taxes. That's less than $140 a year if I'm late. I'm allowed to have any farm animal that I want, but I'm not into that. Except for pigs. I can have cows, horses, sheep. I can have all that. Just can't have pigs. All right. I can grow my own food anywhere I want on the 4 acres. I can have a well drilled on my 4 acres. You can't have any well drilled in Washington, D.C. That ain't happening. I can also legally harvest rainwater on my 4 acres. Once again, going to the property taxes, less than $140 a year. If I'm late, if I pay right now, it's $131 for the whole year. The property tax that I got in Washington, D.C. is over $7,000 a year. There's a monthly sewage fee that they charge even if you don't have the water cut on. Once again, Washington, all the trouble, a lot of the mishaps, a lot of the grief that people suffer, including black folks, happens on just within 4% of the cities in the United States. Pack your shit and move, at least on a part-time basis. All right, so in D.C., once again, I got three monopolies that I got to deal with. And it's the same thing if I go to New York City with Con Ed or whatever they got up there. Same thing in Chicago. Same thing in Seattle, Washington. Same thing throughout the state of California, particularly, you know, what, PG&E, which is all throughout the state, probably in San Francisco, L.A., San Diego. But now, there are places within every state There are places within every state that you can go to. Matter of fact, let's go. We're back on city data. Let's go to the state of New York. Okay, now once again, the largest populated city in the United States is New York City, over 1 million people. And we want to go to cities that have a population. Come on now. We want to go to very small cities, very small towns and villages in New York State that have a population of less than 1,000 people. And I'm on citydata.com if you guys want to follow along. There's a ton of them. Ellisburg, New York, 249 people. Ellicottville, New York, 387 people. Fisher Island, New York, 236 people. These towns are what I call the real United States of America, and there's less politics. I'm going to play this one clip, and I'll go to the phone lines. I played this clip on here before. This is out of Uganda. Okay. Some of the stuff that you're going to hear on this clip, and some of you have heard it before, but I want you to listen differently, hasn't hit the United States yet, but it exists on a daily basis around the world when it comes to solar. But it'll eventually hit New York City eventually.
People who live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this because it remains the property of the client. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits, which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us we have a shaver, so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours, and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working. And then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tonnes of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from SolarNow retailers to get their businesses going.
SolarNow is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now. Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technician, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
The Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Of course, it's cold. The beer tastes better. And so I get more customers.
Now, there are a lot of industries that are happening already in Africa based on solar energy, where it's more favorable politically speaking than it is in developed countries. But if you look like somebody who has a bar and they have a solar refrigerator or a solar freezer, which helps, well, in the case of where they are in Africa, many times in rural Africa, there is no grid. Over here, you got a grid. And when you got a grid over here, well, you got several grids over here, it's politics involved. The larger the city, the more politics. And here's what the pile looks like. You got your people that like coal. Coal helps generate electricity. So you got your political people that they're looking, because my definition of politics is the art and science of protecting your own interests. It's a science as well as an art. So you got people that are in favor of coal. You got people that are in favor of nuclear, as we played the piece yesterday with Ursula Sledeck in their little village in Germany. They didn't want a nuclear power plant. Took them 7 long years, as it stated. But they had to get the money to buy off the plant and shut it down. And now they've gone solar. Now their solar enterprise brings in over 100 million euro a year. And these are just people that started in the pub. So you got nuclear people. The politics of nuclear energy, the politics of coal mines, coal energy, clean coal, if that makes any sense. But you got, it's all, politics is all involved with that. You got your wind politics. You got your solar politics. You know, you got your biofuel politics. And Washington, D.C., once again, I'm familiar with D.C. In Washington, D.C., it is illegal for you to have a propane stove to cook your meals, to bake cakes or pies or whatever in your house in Washington, D.C. proper. Illegal. Banned. Now, my house in D.C. is about 2-3 blocks, short blocks from the Maryland line of Prince George's County, Maryland, Hyattsville, Maryland. Well, they probably call that part of Maryland, either Hyattsville or Chillum, Maryland. If I get in the car, I get in, what, 30 seconds? Well, 45 seconds at the most. If I walk in, 10-minute walk, if that. A 45-second drive from my house to the Maryland line, cross the Maryland line, and in those homes, it is legal if you want to have a propane stove in your home to cook meals, bake cakes, pies, and that type thing. And you see the suburban propane company, you know, zipping around the neighborhood in the Beltway on the Maryland side, delivering propane to individual households and apartment buildings. But in Washington, D.C., 15 seconds away, illegal. Why? It's not in Washington Gas, which is a private company, and they sell natural gas. It's not in their best interest unless they're selling it, and they don't. They don't sell propane. They sell natural gas. Now, my little four-acre spread, matter of fact, anywhere I set foot, my number one choice of, well, for heating fuel is biofuels. Now, 2 miles away from my house in D.C., and you cross over into, this is mind-blowing, into Tacoma Park, Maryland. There's several people, actually, that in their home, they heat their home with biofuels. One of the biofuels that they heat their home up with is corn. This corn doesn't pop, but it's corn. And they have a silo in town that the local people of Tacoma Park, Maryland, you know, let's put this together so when we need to re-up on fuel, which is the biofuel corn, and I've been in their homes in the wintertime, and the main floor and the top floors are nice, very comfortable. They get nothing from which would be because Washington Gas, I think, dabbles into that too, but totally different world. Just cross the street, cross the line. All right. Once again, the politics of household energy. So nuclear energy, municipal water, household electric, natural gas, wind, and all of these. All of them are political. Every last one of them has their politicians. Every last one of them has their lobbyists. All right, but in some places, it's just more prominent. I gravitate towards places where it's friendly for renewables. If I want to put a windmill up, to generate electricity, I can do it. If I want to buy a, I mean, if I want to build a house, Earthship. Earthships are basically homes that are built from stuff that people threw away. Used tires, cob, broken glass, all kinds of stuff. You can't build an Earthship in Washington, D.C. But you can 15 minutes outside of Zanesville, Ohio. And we've had people on here that have at least twice that have built or that live in Earthship. But it's the politics. So what I'm saying is the politics of household energy. The reason why I play the Lamar Alexander video so much, the reason why I play, you know, the 11-year-old, she's 12 years old now, Lauren Nelson, who lives in the camper, because it's people who have campers that call me up. They call me up. They're already there. All right. The solar barbershops, it's not in New York City yet, but it's moving from the rural areas of Africa outside of Kampala, you know, outside of or within Homa Bay, Kenya. It's coming here. The thing about a lot of developing countries, particularly big cities in developing countries, it's wait and see. Wait and see. By the time it gets to New York City or Washington, D.C. or San Francisco or someplace like that, almost half the country is already there. It's already there. So solar refrigerators, solar heaters, solar barbershops, solar beauty salons, solar homes, homes that run completely off of solar energy, businesses that run completely off of renewables, Feldheim, Germany runs off of 100% renewables. Right now in 2021, going into 2022. It might take 10 years. It might take 20 years. It might take 30 years. But it's coming. That's all I'm saying. It's coming. Just like at one time, a lot of people didn't have a phone. Everybody's got a phone, a smartphone, where they can reach anywhere around the globe. At one time, color TV was a luxury. At one time, a push-button telephone was a luxury. And one of the things that we'll be doing at, because all I'm doing with Earth Wealth E-Village is I'm copying off of what I saw over in Europe. In a little small towns like Vauban, just like Chanel with Ursula Sadek and her husband and her neighbors, you know, what I've seen over in China, and we're lined up to go to Africa hopefully next year, East Africa, and we'll be interviewing in person some of the people that you heard in the Rural Energy Foundation thing. I've already met with at least one of those people in person when they were over here in this country. So there's no silver bullet when it comes to household energy. Due to the politics, in some areas they're going to prefer solar. In some areas they're going to prefer hydro. In some areas they're going to prefer coal or clean coal. There's no silver bullet with any of this. All I'm saying is do with the politics of household energy. Because the bottom line with renewables and solar is here's what got me into it. When I saw a heating bill and an electric bill, which was like less than 50, it would translate this into dollars because they wanted a euro when I first saw it, for the whole year. And then I was like Buddha under the Bodhi tree. Then I saw why people get evicted. Then I saw why people get foreclosed on, because they can't pay those high utility costs. I don't get into the polar bears and save the whales and all this stuff. I really, when I was talking green, people understand the word light bill. Earth Wealth E-Village is a zero light bill community. Dubendorf, which is our 10 acres out in Texas, is a zero light bill community. People know what a light bill is. It took me over 10 years to come up with that. People don't care about carbons. They don't care about carbon footprint. They don't care about the... What people care about is what they understand a light bill. E-commerce, Oklahoma, all are zero light bill communities. Places where the politics of household energy is real light, and they're welcoming new ideas and people that are doing something different. What I'm doing now in any of these places, that you can't get. I'm not going to get the front end in Washington, D.C., or New York, or St. Louis, or San Antonio, or Phoenix, Arizona, or San Diego, California. That's why I look for the towns, once again, the Blackjack Oklahomas of the world. Taft, Oklahoma is on a radar with a population of less than 250 people. Blackjack, Oklahoma is not even on the radar, but it's there. They have houses, they have businesses, they have churches. It's on the radar. It's sandwiched literally right next door to Taft, Oklahoma. They have their own graveyard. They're probably as old as Taft. And Taft existed before the state of Oklahoma came into existence. They're just not incorporated. Taft is a municipality. And it's in the Blackjack Oklahomas of Montana, Alaska, California, Maryland, you name it, that's where the action is. There's no silver bullet, once again, for any of the energies. But I'm just telling you, renewables that have been proved, what's going to happen is, or what is happening is, particularly a smart politician, they're going to visit places. Matter of fact, I'll give you a good example. In a place I've been, I'll shoot some videos on, post videos on our Facebook page. Vauban. It's a solar district in Freiburg, Germany, on the edge of the Schwarzwald, which is the Black Forest in Germany. Population, 5,000 or 6,000 people. It's a community that's off the grid. Okay. And you have university students, university professors that take classes. They fly from all over the world that go to Vauban. Sooner or later, if it hasn't happened already, there are going to be some politicians from larger cities that they're going to make a trip there. And they, you know what? We need to have this in our city. The other cities, like Feldheim, Germany, where a part of their electrical production is run off of cow shit. That's not going to fly in Washington, D.C., because, once again, you got the natural gas people of Washington Gas. It's not in their best interest for you to find out how to generate your own electricity. It's not in Washington, and name any municipal water system in the United States. It is not in their best interest for you to know how to drill your own well. It's not in their best interest for that city government that you know how to harvest rainwater. It wasn't in the best interest. Here's what happened with Ursula Sadek and the Chanel people in Germany. The local people educated themselves on how to generate their own electricity and put the electrical grid out of business. It might not, once again, well, that's what Earth Wealth E-Village is. Earth Wealth E-Village is about how you can take your power back, how you can take your household energy power back. Nothing new. The Rural Energy Foundation has done it through several towns throughout Uganda and Kenya. There are several towns throughout Southeast Asia and Asia that have done this. Or I'm not doing anything new. Is it the end of nuclear? No. Nuclear is going to be here. Is it going to be the end of coal? No, coal's going to be. It's still going to be here. But just like that cell phone that Laquanda has at the social services office right now, one day in the future, in the near future, well, it might be 10 years, 15, 20 years, whatever, more and more people will be taking back their household energy power back. And that's what Earth Wealth E-Village is, to show people how to do it. But the other towns right here in the United States, which is in the 47% of the towns in the United States, they have a population of 1,000 people or less. That's where the action is. You're not going to see it in your bigger towns. Okay, now I done ran my mouth for 2 hours. Well, not 2 hours, because we played a lot of audio today. But, well, we got a little time left. 341, you were the inspiration for household energy today. So thank you for that. Your comments.
That's a good idea, but I'm sorry to inform you that it ain't going to work.
But it's
China
already
is
working,
planning
Kiyaki.
On building. China is planning on building 43 new coal-fired plants.
Yes,
we speak.
I'm not disagreeing with anything you're saying. What
Hang
I'm
on for
saying
a second.
Is,
let me go ahead and say.
Okay, what
I'm
go ahead.
Because
I did
run
my mouth for 2 hours. Go ahead.
Yeah. And you made this. Listen to this. Propane is the most common form of LP gas that is permitted in the District of Columbia. Propane is permitted in D.C.
Not when I called you.
LP gas ain't permits required. This is.
Hold, you there?
That provides.
Hello.
This.
Okay, go ahead. No, go ahead. You went
yeah,
out.
Yeah, this is Washington D.C. Fire and EMS Department. They provide the. It's like the fire department.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they propane in D.C.
All right, that's fairly new because when I of course it's been a while since I've called, Because
This is October 1st, 2009. It's been around for, what, 12 years?
All right, all I know is when I called, they told me no.
Now, plus, electricity, I mean, you want to read why come to you getting away from, so they ain't never had no solar to no extent in Germany. The sun don't come up that far.
No, it you doesn't. There's a lot of overcast over there, but it's a lot of solar.
Well, what I'm saying is this. The sun only treks up 22.5 degrees north and south. Mm-hmm. And Germany lies, about 34 latitude. So their panels would have to be practically vertical. Then you got to look for mountains that's in the way and buildings and everything else. Now, in Africa, poverty in Africa.
Okay.
Yeah. And what you're talking about in Africa and Uganda, that is nothing but a novelty. Their purpose is trying to build electrical power generating stations. But mm-hmm. what holds them back is that the people don't have the money. They ain't got the money to pay for solar. They ain't got the money to pay for electricity, let alone solar.
Well, the rural energy, which is now called solar now, and they got other operations. The solar that they've been installing on, and it's mostly in rural Africa. Because even I had the guy on here, Julius.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, the bush.
It's out in the bush mostly.
They don't even have roads out to the bush. Bush planes. Now, do they have these little novelty things like these lanterns that solar power? Yeah, they do. Well, if you look at the major development that's going on in Africa, look at Lagos.
You're not going to get into Lagos like that. Not yet.
Modern development. They ain't using no solar there.
Well, I'm not going to. I can't debate you on that one. But hold it. Let's look at. All right. Let's. You picked a very good city. Lagos is in Africa. Lagos may as well be New York City or Los Angeles, Chicago. And you got people. First thing, I haven't been to Lagos, so I'm just speculating. You probably have been. I'm just speculating based on the population of Lagos. Is you got people with appliances, and the people that live out in the bush don't have appliances. They don't have a washing machine. They don't have a dryer. So their consumption habits or lifestyles are completely different than a person that you might have that lives in Lagos. A big part of this whole renewable thing is lifestyle.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's what. Well, you got a point. Ain't nobody working in no professional job gonna be living in the bush, cause there's no opportunities, professional jobs in the bush. In the bush, people wash clothes by hand. They dry clothes with the sun. You gotta look at what people gonna do for a living. People go to school today not to make a living off of a little neighborhood. Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah, the phone was going out. Well, Piaka,
But I'm not saying that people can't do it and shouldn't do it. Yeah, I'm not saying that people shouldn't do it.
Okay, let me ask you this.
I'm talking about the feasibility of it.
I'm sure in St. Louis, and I haven't been in St. Louis since college, really. I'm sure on the streets of St. Louis, don't they have, like, solar street lights in some places?
No, not that I know of. Well, they have solar assist, but I don't know of any solar street lights put up through sodium in some parts of St. Louis.
All right, because I know in D.C.
Where are people going to go that's working in these industries?
Well, right now, that's a good question that you ask. And there's a movie about that I'm trying to get a go on.
Wait a minute. If they're not working, how are they going to be able to buy consumer goods? That's the middle school. How are they going to be able to pay for education? automobile.
Let me answer one part of that. Okay. Right now, the way I see it, for the solar entrepreneurs, the ones that have a little small mom and pop solar business where they install, you know, solar systems on people's homes, most of those, to my knowledge, in the United States, at least the ones I run across, most of those are mom and pop businesses. And they're selling to people that can basically write a check for $10,000, $15,000,
and
$20,000.
Yeah, but how many people
and a lot
can do
of them
that?
Don't offer
and how
financing.
Often, how often do
how
you have
they
to
get
do
a
that?
Sale?
You know the government used to give you. You know the government used to give you subsidies for that. Didn't nobody take that on. Here's the thing. I attended a Voltaire class in St. Louis.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And we had all the instrumentation. You go out and you can see if the location is cool. It was cost prohibitive. First place, the batteries are on a lifetime. Then you got the equipment itself.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you're gonna have to replace the battery. You're gonna have to replace batteries. But what happens if you got to replace the shingles on your roof? You got to take all that stuff off, and that
costs. Once again, Pianchi, I'm admit, right now, it's although the cost of solar has gone down over the last 10 years, but the average person can't afford it right now. But just like the cell phone, remember when there was the brick that was out, most people couldn't afford the brick. But now everybody
yeah,
got
but
a cell phone.
Here's the thing. You say the average person can't afford it. Well, the people that can't afford it don't want to afford it because they got other things to do. It's just like, for instance, burning wood.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of my houses, I got a wood-gas combination furnace.
Okay.
You can stoke it with wood, logs 20 inches long. When the wood burn down, then the gas kick on. Okay, that's a cool idea, ain't it? Real nice.
Sure,
idea.
I gotta admit that is cool.
That's a Yukon furnace. About 80.
I like that idea.
It was over 100,000 BTU. I think it was 120. But here's
I
the
like
thing,
that
LA.
Idea.
Here's the thing, L.A. I ain't going out there cutting no wood. Because gas is
you retired, man. You've been
gas
there, done that, got
cheap.
The T-shirt.
I put that furnace in back in the late 80s. Gas is too cheap. Now, if you pay somebody to bring you some wood, they're going to make enough money on their wood so they can pay their gas and electric bill at home. They ain't even burning wood.
Culturally speaking, you're absolutely right. Most people, particularly the reason why most people gravitate towards your larger cities, is for the comfort and conveniences and what they perceive as the opportunities, job-wise or whatever, socially also, in your larger cities.
Yeah, plus they got to work.
And you're not going to pull those people out of the cities. But for some people that are the DIY people, you know, and that's where a lot of this goes towards. But
well,
there's not going to be a mass exodus to people, to any of the ideas I'm talking about.
Them people that's do-it-yourself, they trying to lobby politicians to bring electricity, gas, and sewage out to their towns. Why don't they go ahead and put it in themselves and stop trying to raise my rates?
Yeah, I guess some of
then
them
when
are.
They put that in, guess what? People going to start coming out there. Taft, Oklahoma. What's the industry in Taft, Oklahoma?
Church. Oh, a prison. They got two prisons. That's about it.
Oh, how many people work in the prison system?
Oh, I don't know.
It ain't hiring
the
whole town.
They got a men's prison, a women's prison, and they got five churches and a little mom-and-pop carry-out store that sells chips, cookies, and an egg sandwich if you want. That's about it in Taft.
All right, now let me ask you something. People that's raising a family, what kids going to go to school and learn to do that? They going to move to the city.
And
it's the same thing
Muskogee, well, for them to do that, because Taft no longer has a school, like they closed that down by vote. Now they drive, well, they go to Muskogee. kids go to school in Muskogee, 15, 20 minutes away.
Yeah, you know what? Here's the thing, too. We shouldn't even talk about Oklahoma. That's Indian territory. You got black people here, native blacks calling black Indians Americans, and they're not. They're Indian. They're Muscovy, just like you say, Muscovy Creek. But if you look at some of them other areas, some small towns, people that's raising kids in them towns, they ain't going to find no employment in those towns. They're going to go to the big cities. So
that's where they're looking.
Idea, that idea of living off the grid is just that. That's people that stay way out in. No, it's for a minuscule. It's for a minuscule people.
Everybody. Well, look, it's not 10. It's 1:23 before they boot us off. We're going to pick this back up tomorrow. Plus, we're going to go on to trending topics tomorrow. So anything anybody wants to
talk. All right, I'll see you.
Okay, talk.
Okay.